The year was 1957, with Malaya just cementing its newly announced status as an independent sovereign state. It was the dawn of a new era for the country, emerging from years of colonial rule under the British. Meanwhile, in the UK, the first commercial overland bus service, the Indiaman Overland, was launched in 1957. Padigaro Fisher Tours was driven by what has been called a mad Irishman heading from London to Bombay. The yellow bus carried a 22-year-old man named Peter Moss, who was heading east in search of the wider horizons of Asia. I'm Nadia Aziz, and you're listening to the eighth and final episode in our new series on heritage and culture and all things Malaysian. After leaving his childhood in India, Peter Moss lived in the UK for a while, where he became disenchanted. He attempted to return to India, but could not quite find the India that he remembered. He then went further to Southeast Asia, arriving in Penang with the equivalent of $3 in his pockets, bluffing his way to an eventual job as a roving correspondent for the Malay Mail, Malaya's first newspaper.
The newsreel footage I saw of Junku declaring Merdeka at the National Stadium made me feel that people really did understand what independence meant. The really nice thing about the handover was that there wasn't any anti-British feeling. Remarkably, we could be on the Padang in the night before, in watching the celebrations there. We could mingle with the crowd, and we were considered Malayan, you know, just like everybody else. I wasn't there, but my cousin and Uncle and Aunt's family were, and they felt totally at home. They felt safe as houses. No anti-British sentiment at all. I think thanks to Junku and the way he steered the independence. And certainly when I first came, KL was the friendliest of cities, practically open house, open city. My colleagues were of different nationalities, and I was very much at home in their houses. They used to come over to ours. Great freedom.
So the first few years you were here, you witnessed the last years of the Malayan emergency. Did you feel at any time threatened in any way?
Not really. If you went from KL to Port Dickson, for example, you would be stopped by various road checkpoints to see if you were carrying food that might be stolen by communists. So we didn't take much more than enough food for a beach picnic, but we never felt threatened. I'd go with my uncle and aunt and sit on the beach at Port Dickson, have a great picnic, and that was in 1958. End of 57, 58, no sense of danger at all. I remember going to Langkawi in 1958, and even though we were near the northern peninsula, we felt safe as houses. I went on a ferry boat from Kuala Kedah to Langkawi in those days. There was just one ferry boat a day, and there was only one place to stay on the island. It was a place called a sanatorium, which is near Kua, you know, the town. It was on a headland, which is now occupied by a very expensive hotel, I think. But it was your typical four-bedroom rest house, government rest house. So you had to book it. And when I booked it, there was only one room available because the other rooms were all occupied by a circuit judge and his party, who were supposed to arrive on the same ferry that I came on. But they never showed up. So the other three rooms were all empty. There was one Scotsman. I think he was the only Orang Putih on the island. Mahathir was the head of the medical department in those days, but I never met him. I met the Malay forestry officer, and I met McKechnie, his name was, the planter. And of course, they would rush to the sanatorium to see who'd arrived on the ferry boat, because we were the only company they'd have. Life could be pretty boring on Langkawi in those days. And inevitably, the subject would crop up as to which room was I staying in. So I would tell them room number 4. And they'd say, oh, I suggest you change your room because that's the haunted room, you know. And I'd say, really? And they'd say, yes, that's where the Malay police officer was tortured to death and his body was thrown into the sea. I thought, this is obviously some story they've concocted to test my cowardice and check with the sanatorium caretaker as to whether I'd been sufficiently scared to change my room. So I refused to get into this. And the Malay forestry officer told me exactly the same story. And I thought, even more suspicious that these two were in collaboration to see if they could scare the pants off me. So I refused to change my room, but I had a totally sleepless night. It was this huge room. It was about the size of this entire ground floor. Old wooden creaky floorboards and walls with cracks in them, and turkeys and chickens gobbling under the floorboards, and bats flying through the rafters, you know, because it had this open... I was scared stiff. And of course, he turned off the generator, which was the only electricity on the island in those days, turned off the generator at 10 o'clock. And after 10 o'clock, there was only a guttering oil lamp alongside my bed, which cast these fantastic shadows all over the room. And I could see shapes drifting in around me. And I thought, no, I can't stand this, because the mosquito net would make everything look strangely ghostly. So I'd switch off, well, I'd snuff out the oil lamp, and then I couldn't sleep because it was suffocatingly black, and I'd hear these noises approaching my bed, and I'd be desperately trying to light the oil lamp again. And then I swear to God, I actually saw the shape in the door frame. The story was that this Malay policeman had been found with a hand grenade in his possession, and nobody was supposed to carry anything, any arms in the Japanese days. So they tortured him to try and find out where he'd discovered this hand grenade, and they apparently flogged him to death, spread-eagled in the doorway. And I stared at this doorway, and I could swear I saw this shape of spread-eagled in the doorway. And I thought, I'm not going to give in to this. I'm sure it's my mind playing tricks with me. So I actually got out of bed and walked across to the doorway to prove that I was being deceived by my mind inventing this figure. And of course, there wasn't anything there. So either there wasn't a ghost in that room, or else if there was, I'm not psychically in tune. I'm not capable of seeing ghosts, because I didn't see a ghost that much. But it did keep me awake.
So what were the more remote areas you had the chance to see during your 8 years in Malaya?
Yes, I caught the Golden Blowpipe Express up to Kota Baru. When Malaysian Railway had just reopened the line, the first ever train to return on that route, it was an old steam locomotive. The train still runs, and I think it's still called the Golden Blowpipe. But they had to restore all the rails, because the rails had been stolen by the Japanese for the Siam Death Railway. And it took quite a while to replace the tracks. But finally, in 1958, they were ready to open the railway again. And they invited me to travel return journey from Muar, I think, in Johor. Kluang, that's right. In central Johor, more or less. Yeah. And I had a first-class return ticket. I traveled with the engine driver on the footplate, Mr. Lim, his name was. Lovely Chinese guy. It was called the express train, but he was so willing to be helpful that every time I took an interest in the passing scenery, he would slow down to enable me to take photographs. And at one point, when we were alongside the Pahang River, there was a particularly nice stretch of scenery I wanted to photograph, so he brought the train to a halt, and of course, immediately everybody gets out and goes off into the bushes and starts peeing, and you know, and he gets a hell of a job mustering them all back again to continue the journey. That was fun.
What did you see every time the train was stopped? It would have been very different back then, right?
It was a lovely stretch of river, the Pahang River. in those days, of course, it was very much more jungle than it is now. You hardly ever saw oil palm. In fact, when I was in Kuala Lipis rest house, I happened to coincide with Tun Razak, our present PM's father, who was staying there on one of his tours of inspection with his little red book, you know, the rural development scheme. And since we were the only guests, aside from his personal assistant, we had dinner together. And I remember telling him that I was a little bit alarmed about the deforestation of Malaya that was being caused by the opening up of all these development schemes. And he assured me that the forest would take care of itself, it would regrow, and Malaysia would never lose its green cover. But of course, that wasn't true. I mean, what happened was that instead of the forests, the trees were replaced with oil palm, which to me poisoned the landscape. I mean, they're pernicious plants. This was 1962, 63. He was still deputy prime minister in those days. His great mission was the rural development scheme. And I give him credit for the fact that helped to bring the emergency to an end, giving people their own land, you know.
In the capital of the Federation, Premier Tunku Abdul Rahman reads and signs a most welcome proclamation. It officially ends the Malayan emergency after a bitter 12-year jungle conflict with the communists.
The communists had no real reason to carry on the struggle. In fact, I gather from Chin Peng, from his own writing much later, that he went to Beijing to try and persuade Deng Xiaoping there was no point in carrying on the fight. But stupidly, in my opinion, Deng Xiaoping said, no, we must continue fighting. We must cause the last anti-communist strongholds to tumble, you know, until communism has spread throughout Southeast Asia. That never happened, of course. So he went back into the jungle and continued this ridiculous losing fight. Yeah, an interesting Robert Thompson, who arranged for me to go into the Betong Salient with the troops, he was engaged by the Americans to advise them on the same kind of policies that had won the fight against communism in Malaya. But of course it didn't work in Vietnam, because there you were dealing not with minority groups, but with Vietnamese, whom you couldn't identify which was pro Ho Chi Minh and which was pro the government. And of course, you had the Ho Chi Minh Trail down the spine of the country. So they could continue to supply their Viet Cong anytime they wanted. You couldn't win against those odds. But it took Americans years to realize this. Many more lives lost. Very sad.
Speaking of which, you correctly predicted that when they declared the end to the war against communism in Malaya, it wasn't exactly the case.
No. I knew it would go festering on. And that's why that was the tone of my articles. I called it the Forgotten War, pointing out that maybe the rest of the peninsula was free of communism, but there on the border, the struggle was still in progress. And at that stage, there seemed to be no end in sight, you know. We couldn't know how long it would continue. I went up in an Oster aircraft, an observation aircraft, to look for terrorist camps in the jungle. And we did find one. They were always very skillfully screened. But the trouble was, looking through the forest canopy and seeing glimpses of thatched hut, you couldn't be certain that the camp was still occupied. It might have been an abandoned base, you know. So you were calling in coordinates for bombers to come and strafe these camps. And often they were strafing into camps.
You've been listening to episode 8 of the first season of Malaysiana on heritage, culture, and all things Malaysian. Stay tuned as veteran journalist Peter Moss recounts his search for distant archipelagos, which eventually became the name of his memoirs for life in Malaya. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to episode 8 of the first season of Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz. We're speaking to veteran journalist Peter Moss, who was a roving correspondent with the Malay Mail and NST in the decade after Merdeka. What other memories or adventures do you particularly remember from your time in Malaya?
Going to the Klang Gates Reservoir, which in those days was the first natural reservoir to supply KL. I gather it's now part of a much bigger scheme. But in those days, it was right across the trail of an elephant track, because it was a fairly narrow valley that went where they dammed up the reservoir dam. And the caretakers, the Indian caretakers who looked after the place at night when the contractor's team had withdrawn, would have to be holed up in their hut because the elephants were wreaking their revenge on overturning cement mixers and causing as much chaos as possible, because they were very angry at having their old route being closed to them, you know. I was with the name of the Minister of Works, lovely guy, and we went up on a platform lifted with four chains, no safety harness, no safety helmets. We were yanked up and swung over this reservoir on this platform. I've still got a photograph. All of us suspended in midair, and people were shocked that we were allowed to go up in those conditions. A chap called Homer Byington, who was the American consul. The Americans had contributed some of the funds for the Klang Gate Reservoir. Being typically American, they wanted their name in a plate on the wall of the dam, you know. I hope it's rusted away.
Well, the main object of Malaysia plan is to give independence to those countries who have been invited to join this Malaysia. And that would end colonialism in this part of the world, and give no opportunity to the communists to work and poison the minds of people there.
Were you here during the formation of Malaysia?
Actually, I was up in the Cameron Highlands with a lot of other pressmen when Duncan Sands, who was the exterior Home Affairs Minister for Britain, came and tried to sell Tunku and the Sultan of Brunei and Prime Minister of Singapore, how can I forget his name, Lee Kuan Yew, tried to sell them the idea of stitching together this weird collection of territories which had absolutely nothing in common on the grounds that it could form a greater Malaysia. And they all went for this, hook, line, and sinker. I thought it was a ridiculous idea. And quite rightly, Sukarno understood it was an anti-Sukarno idea, you know. So he declared confrontasi. And a lot of lives were lost as a result. I was on the golf course when they were discussing all this while playing golf in the Cameron Islands. And Duncan Sands spoke to the press and reported on the progress of the talks, and I wasn't impressed.
So what was Britain's stake in all this?
Britain wanted to dump its last colonies, you know. It had become a bit of an embarrassment for Britain. America, which is jealous of British territories all along, having only had one in the Philippines. By 63, there weren't too many colonies left. The only one they held on to, of course, was Hong Kong, which was fascinating that the first and last colonies were to secede or to leave the Commonwealth. So India in 47 and Hong Kong in 97, 50 years apart. Quite interesting, that 50-year cycle. That's why I thought I would write about my memoirs on the basis of three volumes, one being India up to 47, Malaysia up to 57, and Hong Kong up to 97.
The British supported the formation of Malaysia, and they held a referendum with Sabah and Sarawak. Did you cover that as well?
I didn't. I think that referendum took place just after the talks, yeah. That wasn't part of my brief. I didn't cover the referendum. I didn't get to Sabah until 1967, when it was still Jesselton, and the minister was Mustafa, the one who imported a lot of Filipinos to jack up the so-called Malay majority. But nobody told Tunku that even though ethnically you might classify Sarawakins and Sabahans as Malay, they weren't Muslim. Nothing to do with Islam. It was a big Christian community, of course. So it's very aggravating to people with Malay-sounding names to be regarded as Muslim and classified as Muslim when they're not. They're actually Christian. A lot of the Filipinos in Sabah are Christians themselves.
You mentioned earlier the confrontasi. What was the sentiment like on the ground among Malayans?
Funny you should say that, because Mokti and I went up from this kampong to Sabat Bernam. And you know that whole coastal strip is largely Javanese, right? And I remember when we got to Sabat Bernam, I was chatting with the people we met there. And I asked them, what would happen if an Indonesian paratrooper dropped over this town? Would you take him prisoner and hand him over to the military? And said, no, of course not. He's our brother. He's one of us. Why would we want to surrender him to the military? So I got the impression that loyalties were very divided, actually, certainly along the West Coast. I subsequently, in Hong Kong, I met somebody from the Rio Archipelago who'd been a Red Beret commando on the Indonesian side. And he had taken part in one of those drops. In his case, he realized that the Hercules aircraft they were flying in was heading off course. The pilot was scared stiff of running into anti-aircraft fire over the Malacca Straits. So he was heading for Kalimantan on the wrong course entirely from Jakarta. You know, he was going northeast instead of northwest. So this guy, forgotten his name now, he had a Christian name, let's call him Danny, forced his way into the cockpit and held a pistol against the pilot's head and said, turn this aircraft round right now, put us back on the course to Johor, where they were supposed to be dropping, somewhere near Batu Pahat, as I recall, or I'll kill you. And this pilot had to do that. So he parachuted along with a few others over Johor, but they got separated. They didn't land in a cluster, they were scattered, which of course subsequently made it very easy to pick them off. And Danny ended up with a contact on the coast who he had been told would help him. But he realized this guy was a double agent who was actually going to hand him over to the police. So Danny shot him and subsequently got captured and went to prison in Changi, where they were holding some of these Indonesian infiltrators. God knows how he managed it, because I never did discover how, but he managed to make his escape from Changi prison and got back to the Riau Archipelago again.
Newly independent Malaya, when you first arrived, was very different from the Malaysia that exists now. If you could have your perfect vision for the country, what would that be?
Well, basically an impossible dream, returning to what it was then. Not Little Arabia, which is what KL has now become. Much greater freedom of religion than you have now. No intolerance. I wasn't aware of any ethnic unrest at all until 1969. I was in Hong Kong. Mokti was with me before the riots, and he and his family went with me around the country. We went up to the Cameron Highlands. And I don't know, something, you might call it suggestibility after the event, but I detected a different mood even in 1969. So I'd been away for 4 years. And things didn't, there was a certain amount of tension. Political atmosphere was getting a little fraught. I went back on home leave. That's right. I was in England when the disturbances occurred. And I came back to Hong Kong immediately afterwards in early June that year. But I stopped in Malaysia on the way back in order to check on the family, because Nokti and his wife and kids had come back to Ijo at that stage. And I was worried that the tension that had prevailed in KL had spread to other cities. But when I came back, I was invited to Mokti's brother's wedding, Sharif, who lives just up the road. And quite a large number of the guests were local Chinese from the local village at Simpang Tiga. So here it was as if nothing had happened, you know. There was no tension at all. And it's still like that, thank God, you know. There's still a free and easy attitude here. I wish we could return to those days. Don't see much hope of it happening politically. It would take a strong man somebody with real charisma and leadership. I don't see that person waiting in the wings, sadly.
If you missed the full interview with veteran journalist Peter Moss or other shows in the Malaysiana season, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. You've been listening to Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz, on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.